Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to industry leaders, innovators, and pharma execs sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. This week, I am joined by Brian Spillman. Brian is the Chief Growth Officer at Advara. Brian, welcome to the show. I guess I have not necessarily come across Advara until recently. So it'd be great if you could perhaps give us, I guess, an intro or overview of yourself and the company in your own words, really.
Yeah, happy to. And first of all, thanks for having me. It's exciting to be here. So Advara is the leading provider of safety and compliance, integrated safety and compliance solutions for clinical research. Mm-hmm. That could be a lot of things. So let me try to define a little bit more about what we mean by integrated safety and compliance solutions. Mm-hmm. Pharma, when they conduct a clinical trial, are heavily reliant on two outside parties. One are clinical trial participants, right? And the other are clinical research sites. Mm-hmm. These sites are not owned by pharma, and the participants are not pharma employees, mm-hmm. but they're critical to the success of clinical research. And so what we focus on is, let's talk about the participant journey first.
Yeah.
That participant, the first thing we do, are the market leader in institutional review services, effectively ethics reviews, to make sure that clinical trials are safe for human subjects. So they don't go through, you know, you're putting yourself as a participant in clinical trial to great sacrifice for the good of, for the greater good. Let's make sure you're doing that where we eliminate or at least reduce any unnecessary risk. So, you know, if there's a compound already out there that's highly effective, maybe certain tests and certain experiments may not make some sense. So those are, that's one of the things that we do. That's our integrated, that's our IRB. We then have a safety, we have a training solution to enable participants in clinical research to be properly trained on the study. What do they need to go through? What tests they need to take? How's this going to work? So they have a pretty good view of how things look from study initiation to study close, from that first visit to the last visit, and then what their expectations are. And we keep a running communication with those participants throughout the trial. So think of that as the participant journey. And that's about safety, and it's also about compliance.
Yeah.
On the site side, clinical research sites. So clinical research sites are really the engines of clinical research globally. And we work with them in a couple of different ways. One is we obviously review protocols on behalf of clinical research sites, as well as on behalf of pharma and CROs. Mm. We also provide site training solutions. So the same sort of training solutions we're providing for participants, we're also providing for sites. So they can understand what steps they need to take, how should they engage with the patients? What is this compound supposed to do? Mm. All of those things. So the other side of that participant equation is this training and this training platform and other capabilities around safety reporting, et cetera, that we do on that side. And then probably most importantly, or I shouldn't say most importantly, equally importantly, right? We have clinical trial management solutions and regulatory binders and a whole set of solutions that are used by the largest clinical research sites on the planet, really. Throughout the U.S., I think we've got 83% of NCI-designated cancer centers use our clinical research platform to conduct all of their clinical research. So not just research around, you know, what the big pharma companies or biotechs or med device companies are looking for, but even their own institutional research, investigator-initiated trials, all of that stuff, all of those trials are in our system. So if you think about that's heavily about compliance, right? Making sure you have the right data in the right place, moving that participant through the trial from initiation to conclusion. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty broad portfolio, but that's why I said there's a lot there to safety and compliance.
Yeah.
But if you take it in the framework of the participant journey and the site journey, I think it becomes a little bit easier to digest.
Kind of, just think of a roadmap for each. So is it kind of like, I'm just thinking of like an IRB, but it sounds like you're more like an independent oversight institution, committee. I don't know how to label it. Is that?
Well, that's, I mean, that's a fact. I mean, thank you. That's effectively an IRB. So in Europe, it's a little different than the US, right? So in Europe, it's institutions that are generally conducting their own ethics reviews on the trials that they run through their institutions. And we have that in the US, but the predominant or the dominant ethics review board we have, ethics review board methodology we have in the US is called a commercial IRB. And that's what we are. And so we're the market leading commercial IRB in the US. And so instead of, you know, if, for example, pick a life sciences company wants to run a trial, it's much more efficient to have it run through a central ethics review board than it is to go to each individual academic medical center, integrated health system, and have it go through their internal systems. First of all, we meet 5 days a week. We, you know, our ethics review boards, we have very quick turnaround times, industry leading turnaround times. When there's a modification, we can turn those modifications around really quickly. Mm-hmm. When you go to an institutional IRB, you know, this is not their day job. Yep. You have to gather them. They meet a couple of times a month, and it really slows the process down. So we think there's a lot of efficiency and also a lot of value to be gained by the scale of an institutional review board of our size, reducing patient risk, because we've seen so many different trials and we see all the latest. And I mean, we see 50% plus, maybe 60% of all clinical trials in the US are running through our IRB. And now it doesn't mean we, you know, that's going necessarily all through sponsors. It could be going through sites that we're working with. Mm-hmm. So that sort of scale and visibility enables us to be much more effective at understanding issues or understanding things that might seem like issues, but really aren't issues. So that's, hopefully that helps.
Perfect. No, it does. And I guess your role then as chief growth officer, what does that entail? Because I guess it can, again, probably a broad term again, isn't it really, Brian? What does that mean to kind of your everyday individual who, you know, either, you know, works in clinical research, but isn't familiar with kind of these lofty titles as it may be?
Oh gosh, I'm glad the title works.
Yeah, it's a winner. I like it.
Exactly. The idea is to be, you know, deliberately vague, maybe. Yeah. What I'm on my day-to-day responsibility is really looking after company strategy, looking after mergers and acquisitions, looking after corporate communications and how we position ourselves to the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's always special projects that come up. So I incubated within my team our data science effort. And then once it had been incubated, we moved it into the chief commercial office, the chief technology officer's organization. Uh-huh. So I think about this role in both, there's organic and there's inorganic. So organic, what we do inside the organization, inorganic, what we do outside, but also helping to think about innovation, helping to make sure we're at the vanguard of thought leadership in our industry. And so that's why I like the idea of tying strategy to communications, tying strategy to that corporate brand. Because, you know, I think there's a lot of things that companies do that just don't get talked about as much as they should. And I think our clients see us for who they think we are, not sometimes who we really are and all the great stuff in addition to the things that we do day to day. And I think part of my role as chief growth officer is to think about those different growth vectors, both, you know, internal growth, external growth, partnerships, all those sort of things. That helps.
Wow, it is. I mean, it does sound like quite an interesting role and quite diverse, you know, with the innovation, the internal growth, the mergers and acquisitions. Certainly must keep you very busy. How does someone get into a role like this, Brian? I mean, what's your background? How did you stumble across this type of role, I guess?
You know, they say, James, better lucky than good, right? But I guess if we take the framework, so maybe I'll walk my way backwards and then we can walk it forwards. Yeah. So I spent many years in investment banking as an advisor to some of the largest and some of the most innovative technology companies, and did that for a dozen years. So I, maybe a little bit more, spent, you know, that spend a lot of time doing that, which sort of gave you a framework for both how do you consult to companies, how do you understand their financial structure, how do you mm-hmm. think about transactions. So I had been at, in 2011, I was a partner at Centerview Partners in New York, and I felt like it was time for a change. And I got lucky in the sense that a good friend of mine who's happened to be a lawyer and happened to be the outside counsel to Medidata had a conversation with him and said, look, I'm looking to do something different. And he said, we said, what are you looking for? I said, well, I mean, I'm looking for a large private or small public technology company based in New York City, because at that strange time in the world, people like to actually go into offices every day. So I, live in New York.
Gone are the days.
I know. Who would ever think that you wanted to be in a company, you wanted to live in the same town where your company was based? Mm. And I met the founders of Medidata during that process, and we hit it off, and they brought me on board, and I spent the next 5 years really understanding the clinical research space, but also bringing thoughts and ideas from broader technology and broader company positioning. And really, we really transformed the way that that company was positioned in the marketplace. And, I'm proud because we were able to really, through a lot of different initiatives that, I helped drive as part of the team, but we were able to take it's a sort of like a badge of honor when you can take a company from, at the time I joined, it was trading at 7x EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. And when I left, it was trading at over 7x revenue. Wow. So it was a really big transformation of the business. And part of it was, it was a bit unknown. The market, it was a really interesting SaaS. What word am I looking for? Vertical SaaS company, but really thinking of itself a lot more like a CRO. And I think we really decided that this is really a SaaS company, a technology company that happens to serve this vertical market.
Yeah.
And we did a lot. I'm also thinking about growth versus profitability. Company was profitable, but the question is, how profitable did it need to be? Mm-hmm. And so our view was, it was better to iterate towards a bit more growth and a bit less profitability, and all these processes. And we did a lot of internal exercises to continue to develop and move the business forward. So that's how I got started. And that's helpful experience. So, from banking to Medidata. And then I did a couple of things between Medidata and Advara, one outside the industry, one in the industry, a little bit more on the commercial side of pharma. And I have to say, getting back into the clinical research part of the industry, and now a little over 3 years at Advara, I don't think I'd want to work in any other part of the pharmaceutical life cycle. I really think that clinical development has all the elements of, the excitement of creating something new, but scale, because there's just a lot of investment that goes into development, a lot of opportunities for improvement, and I think technology somewhat unlevered, but somewhat underlevered, at least in terms of the way that it can be positioned. So a lot of good stuff. So hopefully that helps. It's a little bit of a different journey, but I think you take sort of that banking skill, marry it with strategy, marry it with industry, and get lucky.
There's a lot of people, Brian, that have fallen into clinical research in one way or another. It sounds like you're just another one on that list. So you've been with Advara for 3 years. How did that jump come about? Where, it sounds like performance-wise with the likes of Medidata, and I, won't go into all of the other companies, but you produced clearly. Were you headhunted across by an individual like myself, a recruiter, or was it through connections, your network? How did you end up at Advara?
Yeah, so don't be disappointed. It was through connections, not through headhunting. But I'm not opposed. Wouldn't have been opposed if that were the direction as well. Similar to the transition from Centerview to Medidata, it was a similar transition from, I was at the Internet Brands, which is the parent company of WebMD at the time. And I had conversations with some of the board members who I knew just from the industry, Advara board members, and they introduced me, and actually a good friend who used to work with Gadi at Parexel, Gadi's previous, our CEO's previous custom company. And we had a conversation and we sort of hit it off, and he started his role in April of 2020. Interesting timing. I started mine in June of 2020. So just right after he got started, he said, let we were able to kind of work on things. And the funny thing, it was sort of during the heart of COVID, and I was at home working the whole time. And my wife said to me, you know, I think you need to go visit your boss. I think it was August. And I think she was basically telling me it's time to get out of the house. You need to go. So, and then I, you know, that was the first time I actually had met Gadi. And then I made regular trips up to Boston and, you know, by car, by ferry, whatever the transportation was. But that's how it happened. It was good timing.
I'm just thinking, I mean, because it must have been a bit of a crazy time. You must have joined, like, kind of, in, as you said, at the heart of COVID, where none of us knew what was going on in the world, let alone at work. What did the business look like at that time then? Be interesting, because obviously you've come in and then all of a sudden, you know, global lockdowns were happening.
Well, I'd say that like every other company in the life science industry, or that served the life science industry in that time, there was a massive amount of tailwind, right? I mean, you were, you know, there were, in addition to the sort of regular trials, some were delayed, but others were continuing. There was just a bolus of COVID trials. And so as you know, we reviewed 100% of Operation Warp Speed trials during that time. So our IRB was super busy, you know, throughout that process. And then frankly, we were super busy acquiring companies. I mean, we had, so I, you know, a little bit of history of the company. The company was really a roll-up of IRBs. Small IRBs, medium-sized IRBs coming together to create, at the time, the number two, and I think today the number one IRB in the US. And that's really the only market that has commercial IRBs. So I could say we're the number one on the planet, but that would with a lot of X's around other countries that could be included, or other continents that would be included. So GenStar had acquired the company about a little over a year before I joined. They had bought a business called Forte Research Systems, which was the first foray into a software, this sort of site technology that we were talking about earlier, the market leader in academic medical centers and, you know, really large cancer centers. That's the base of that business. And so there was this big IRB business and then this interesting software company, but there was no connection between the two, and we needed to sort of do a little bit of both. We needed to scale that software business, and we needed to find a better way to connect our IRB to our site technology business. And so with all this COVID stuff going around, I mean, you didn't get to meet your colleagues face to face. I mean, we met them the same way we're having this conversation. If you've acquired companies without meeting them, just having these sort of conversations, at least in the beginning. But we ended up buying six companies during an 18-month period of time, mostly during COVID, where we augmented our site technology business by buying another business that kind of gave us integrated health systems and commercial sites. So we had that. We bought I used to call it the bridging technology. Now, how do you bridge between an IRB and a site technology? So we bought a business called Longboat. Now, it's not a bridge, but it was close to, at least it was a boat. So it had something to do with water. Anyway.
Okay.
Very tenuous, right? But that was a business that based in Ireland, and has been a great add-on for us, but is really around connecting sites and sponsors through training. So remember, we talked about training in the beginning. We talked about patient education. That comes from that Longboat business that we acquired. And then we picked up some consulting businesses, some more IRB businesses. So really scaled the company. Did COVID make it harder or easier? I don't know. I mean, I'd say it's probably a wash. You know, not being able to go and meet with companies was not great. But then, just like everything else, things got to be geared towards being able to have these sort of conversations remotely, and we had good advisors that were able to help us. And I also think that just that the momentum around the life sciences industry at that time was really helpful. And our investors, you know, Genstar in particular, was super supportive of growing the business from that perspective. And then, and then I guess just to sort of close it off, we sold the business to Blackstone and the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board about a year ago. The deal closed. So for the, you know, for most of 2022, you know, starting sort of in January and getting through to August, we were involved in a sale process that took a lot of time. But before then, we were buying and integrating.
Busy times, really.
Yes, totally.
So how's it going now then? I guess it sounds like there was a few acquisitions there, bringing things together. I mean, what is the importance of, you know, collaborative endeavors like this in clinical trials? What do you think?
Sure. No, I think they're hugely important, right? There are different approaches that are taken in this industry. And so one approach is the kind of monolithic, buy everything from me and I'll try to solve all your challenges. Kind of like, you know, the traditional ERP approach, like, you know, at Oracle would say, buy my HR software, buy my financial system. Mm. It all works. And, you know, and there is a company in the space that's attempting to do something like that. Our approach is a bit different, and I think more consistent with the idea that this is an industry that's growing, but also one that doesn't want to be vendor dependent on single vendors. Mm. And that's really this idea of thinking about the workflow and really thinking about when we're not thinking about every aspect of clinical research, we're really thinking about the aspects of clinical research that we can have the most impact in. So if you think about that patient journey or the participant journey and the site journey, that's what we're building our technology capabilities and our service capabilities around. And we'll connect to any technology. I mean, we're very happy. You know, we don't want to be a sponsor data capture business. We don't want to be a sponsor CTMS. There's plenty of solutions to do that, but we're happy to integrate with any of those companies to make clinical research more effective. And I think that's, I'm not going to call it a more enlightened approach because that's pretty arrogant. I just say I think it's an approach that's more consistent with the values of this industry, which are really around collaboration. I mean, even the biggest pharma companies collaborate with smaller pharma companies, even, you know, and there's government organizations, you know, the NIH and others that help fund and drive collaboration. So we don't subscribe to this monolithic one approach. We think there's strength in multiple types of solutions, whether it's ours or others. And what we'll do with our platform is enable integration.
Yeah.
In most cases, you know, obviously if we're doing something, our solution is a better solution, there's probably less of a need for integration. But if there are things that we don't do or don't do as well, or something that our client wants, we'll always be flexible to try to make that happen.
Sure. Look, I guess with all this innovation, tech, you know, what would you say is the impact of, you know, all of these different emerging technologies, not just from yourselves, but from others as well, on the future of clinical trials in terms of, you know, both the benefits and the challenges that companies are facing? Because, I mean, at the moment, I've seen a few companies that have fallen foul to newer methods. What's your kind of opinion on all of this?
Yeah, look, I think it's like I like to say that, you know, at a high level, you know, data is a solution looking for a problem, right? You need to define what it is that you're trying to solve, right? Before you just throw technology at the problem. So I think there's a few things. One is, again, going back to let's talk about the site journey. Unfortunately, clinical research sites bear the brunt of all of this innovation and all this concept of innovation that pharma and CROs and companies around the industry are developing. And some sites in a particular trial could have 17, 18 different technology solutions that they need to log into.
Wow.
That's not sustainable. So I think, you know, the best idea, there's some great ideas, needs to keep in mind, not just it looks great for the in this industry, for the person that's buying it, call it the life sciences company, but it really has to work for the site. And if it doesn't work for the site, or it's disruptive to the site, or it causes what we call unnecessary burden, that becomes a challenge. So what we think of is, sites have their own technology. You know, we provide a lot of it. Is there a way to streamline what the sites need to interface with? Can they just interface with the CTMS that they do all their trials, whether they're commercial or their institutional trials or their investigator-initiated trials? Isn't there some way to use that system and then connect to a sponsor EDC or some other sponsor system? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a movement towards recognizing that we need to make, we meaning the life sciences industry, needs to make life easier for sites so that sites participate regularly in clinical research. I mean, remember, the participation rate of doctors is in the single digits that participate in clinical trials. This is not like 50% of all medical professionals. It's more like a couple of percent. There's a lot of turnover. So even if you do one trial, there's so much burden, you might not want to do another. Right. Also, and I think the thing that sometimes the industry forgets is that, at least at large academic medical centers, clinical trials is a money-losing business. Institutions, large academic medical centers, lose 50 cents of every dollar spent in clinical research. Children's hospitals could lose a dollar on every dollar spent. Now, again, there's lots of funding, you know, funding that comes in from third parties, grants, things like that, at least for children's hospitals. But there's other reasons why they do this work, similar to the reasons why participants do clinical research. You know, there's honor, there's glory, there's doctors and investigators like to participate in clinical research. It keeps them on the cutting edge of technology.
Definitely.
But we got to make it easier for these organizations. So I'd start there as a warning that if we overburden sites, we are cutting off the most important constituent in the clinical trial process. Because you don't have sites, you don't have clinical trials. Mm. I know DCT was a very hot topic during COVID, and we thought we could move everything to decentralized trials and eliminate the sites. The sites aren't getting eliminated. And frankly, participants in clinical trials really do like to go to sites and meet with medical professionals and talk about what they're going through and have that experience. That's another reason to participate and keep people engaged in clinical research. Mm. So that's on one side, but I do think there's a lot of benefits. I mean, you asked like benefits of technology. I mean, we should be able to make this process more and more efficient. And the idea of actually giving participants the power to understand what they're going through, to actually even be able to contribute some of their data through remote modalities, as long as it can be properly measured. Those things are really exciting. All the data and analytics that's out there. Again, solution looking for a problem, but let's define it. Can we identify better sites? Can we identify better patients? Can we identify, you know, can we help hone in on the right inclusion-exclusion criteria? Can we make trials more successful? Because if we can't find the needle in a haystack participant, well, maybe we should widen our inclusion-exclusion criteria. So protocol design and all those other things, there's all sorts of advances that are exciting, but I think we should be very careful about running technology experiments on our sites that really just want to complete the work in the easiest, simplest way possible. And I think letting them use their own technology, I call it BYOT, you know, bring your own technology as opposed to BYOD, you know, bring your own device, but same sort of idea.
Mm. Awesome. Well, it sounds like you've got your head screwed on here, and you're happy to acknowledge that there's both benefits and challenges. In terms of, I guess, the changes that you've seen since you joined Advara, you know, those challenges and, of course, the growth that you've already spoken about, what would you say has perhaps been the biggest challenge that you've faced? But also, I'd be interested to hear about your own, I guess, biggest win, if that makes sense, kind of like a biggest success story from your end.
Yeah, look, I'll get to biggest win after. I think the challenges are always, you know, look, it's pharma is blessed by being highly profitable, right? And also highly regulated. That does tend to drive risk aversion, which is, there's nothing wrong with it. And in fact, they should be risk averse.
Mm.
But that does make change sometimes difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you attempt change, you know, there's forces that always say, well, let's just keep doing things the same way that we did it, because we're not going bankrupt if we don't make the change.
It's natural.
Right. And so I think we have to continue to make sure that we recognize the risk aversion of our primary clients, you know, the life sciences industry, but also give them reasons to make these changes. And look, you know, just because they're highly profitable doesn't mean that they're wasteful, and nor should they be wasteful. And so mm-hmm. the idea of actually coming up with this great idea, if it doesn't have an ROI that's recognizable or achievable in some reasonable period of time, I don't know why one would assume that a client would buy that. And so I think we just, as an industry, there's lots of interesting, innovative companies. I think I've spent too much time looking inside than looking outside. And I think we just have to keep looking at our clients and make sure that what we're doing is really adding value to them, as opposed to primarily adding value to us. Now, win-win is always good, but we just have to make sure that we're doing stuff that, you know, that really drives value for the industry. And so I do think sometimes there's some stuff that just, it's another Me Too. It's a third X, or it's a third, fourth, fifth. Let's innovate where innovation can make a difference. Like a drug, you know, it's like when they develop compounds. If you're the seventh on the formulary, that's going to be tough. It's going to be really hard.
Yeah.
to create a business. But if you're the first on the formulary because you were first to market with something really innovative and new, great. The market values you. I think we have to look at technology the same way. That's the way we look at technology. You know, that's the way we think of our opportunity in this industry, is if we're going to innovate, let's innovate to drive real value for the industry and long-term sustainable value for the industry.
Awesome.
So I think that's a challenge. I think biggest win, it's a good question. I mean, I think to some extent, I think successfully identifying and integrating the companies that we acquired and mm-hmm. building and helping to transform Advarra from primarily an IRB to an integrated safety and compliance provider with both technology and services. Mm-hmm. I think that was a big win. And that's not my win. I mean, it's a win for the team, but I do think our efforts on strategy and our efforts on M&A helped accelerate that transition, and probably wouldn't have happened if we weren't able to acquire the business that we did. But we have work to do. I mean, you know, our business is still and probably will be for the foreseeable future heavily weighted towards IRB, IBC, and, you know, review services. We're going to continue to invest in technology and grow our technology business internally, you know, organically and inorganically, but, you know, not to just catch up, not to balance the business for argument's sake, but for what makes sense for our clients. So I've been proud of that. And I think I'm proud of the team that I work with. You know, it's a great team. It's people that are mission driven and really care about what they do. And that makes a big difference as well.
Amazing stuff. Well, I have to give you a 10 out of 10 for modesty there, Brian, because I think, if I was the chief growth officer and all of these things had happened, I'd probably been, banging my own drum a little bit more. But the fact that you're talking about the team is quite refreshing. I guess more on the personal front then, what have you learned about yourself on this journey since you started out? Have you changed much, I guess? If we take you back to like 2011, for example, working in the banking and finance world, how have you changed as an individual? Do you think you have or not?
No, I think I actually have. You know, sometimes I think I haven't, but in the end, I think I really have. And some advice that the CEO of Medidata gave to me when I first started was, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about, because banking was all about sprinting, right? You sprint from deal to deal. I mean, you know, maybe a marathon relationship with a client, that sounds arduous, but it's not supposed to sound that way. It's, you know, but you're sprinting on deals and trying to get them done as quickly as possible. And it's the thing, not the people, the thing, getting the deal done, not. And I think what I really learned here is, it is a marathon, not a sprint. And yeah, there are moments you have to boogie and move a lot faster, but building strong relationships with your colleagues, building relationships of trust with your colleagues, with your, you know, with the ecosystem, with clients, is the most sustainable way to ultimately have a successful company and have a successful career. And I think, you know, could be age, I don't know, but I think slowing down a little bit to sort of take that in and think about that, and to recognize that, you know, it's almost like when people say, you know, slow down before you press send on an email. I think it's take a deep breath, make sure what you're doing is fit for purpose and is long-term. You know, not everything one does is going to be long-term, but I think the idea of helping to build a business, not for today, but for tomorrow and the next day, and something that's sustainable, I think is something that, you know, I recognize. I mean, you know, look, coming out of banking, it was like, how do you get the share price up? How do you drive as much accretion as possible through this transaction? There was just a lot of short-term stuff, which is what your clients wanted to hear and what they wanted you there for. But it's very different than what you do when you're inside a company. And you know, I used to say it's fun to be in a company because you know what you didn't know. You know, from banking, you really don't know what you don't know because you're not inside the company. You know what the company wants you to know and then what third parties tell you, but you're not there every day meeting with, you know, having meetings, hearing the challenges and everything else. You're restricted. When you're within a company, you know everything. Then the question is, what do you do with that information? How do you work with it? But I do think those are things I've learned. I think I like that advice. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And that's what I think about now. What's long-term sustainable? How do you drive long-term growth versus how do you have some quick hits?
Sure. So a bit more balance on the profits and purpose, I guess, to sum that up.
Totally. It's easy in this industry though, James, right? Because there's always purpose. No matter what you do, you are having a part in getting a life-saving compound to market somewhat faster, somewhat safer, somewhat more compliantly, whatever, however you want to define it.
Yeah.
And that's actually super exciting.
Amazing. And look, I guess what's next on the cards for yourself and the business then? Is it more of the same? Is there more innovations? Are you going to add to the service offering in any way, shape, or form?
Look, we'll continue to look across the business. And then, you know, it's not just where we are today, but where else can we go? Where are the touch points for growth? And what are the adjacencies? So I'd say that we'll continue to look at businesses within review services. There are not a lot of them around. You know, there's been a lot of consolidation in the space, but we'll continue to look. We'll continue to look at technology businesses in and around the things that we do. But I think one thing I'm comfortable at least saying is part of the strategy is really thinking through this participant journey and the site journey and what fits within those. But then also, look, if we want to be a good partner to our clients, we want to be a better and more important partner to the clients every day. So if there are businesses that are adjacent and that make sense, we'll go into those businesses. We'll either acquire, or probably if we're going to go adjacent to create enough scale, you probably have to acquire. The other thing is we are fairly innovative, but we could do more on the innovation front. We're doing a bunch of stuff like everybody else with generative AI. But I think, you know, it's not just coming up with a good marketing report written through chatbot, right? That's nice. But I think, what sort of capabilities can we leverage through technology to make our clients, give them more visibility, get them faster answers, better analytics? those sort of things we think about. So I think there's a little bit of those things. I wouldn't, you know, I think we've got to look, the core of the business is strong and solid and growing well. It's just how do we, but it's, and look, I think Blackstone and the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board felt that way about the business. That's why they bought it. But they also are highly supportive of continued growth and expansion of the business as well. So does that help? I mean, I think that kind of gives the
I
answer.
I think so,
lots of components.
A good summary. And I mean, we won't even dive too deeply into the AI side of things. Otherwise, that's another podcast all in itself, isn't it?
Totally.
But no, look, I think you've given a great overview here of, I guess, your role and Advara. And I guess that I'd like to keep in touch. But before I guess, let you go, we always wrap up the show with a quick fire questions round. So I'm not sure if you're ready for it, but...
I'm going to have a quick drink of water and then I'll be ready.
All right, fire away, James. Question, I guess, taking you back to your younger self, what's the one piece of advice that you'd maybe give to your younger self?
That's such a, it's a good question. I know I should be prepared for these sort of questions, but I would say I never have. I'd say, look, embrace change and, you know, don't be fearful of it. Status quo is comforting, but it's also a choice. And it's not always the best choice. Sometimes it is. Sometimes staying the course is a good choice. But be open to just different adventures. And if your mind is open to that sort of thing, and, you know, maybe there's a goal, but that goal can be achieved in different ways. I think you then get a little less distressed about momentary setbacks, because I think it's easy to say, oh my God, look what just happened. I'm crestfallen. It's over. As opposed to saying, look, it's part of the journey. Yeah, we'll stumble. You'll stumble, little Brian. You will stumble sometimes, and you'll fall, and you'll scrape your knee, and you might break an arm, and it might feel like the end of the world. But, you know, if you persevere and you're true to yourself, you'll end up okay.
I like that, Brian. I have a feeling that you must have broken an arm at some point as well.
Actually, I didn't, but my son has. And so
there you go.
And I for him, we keep him, you know, we remind him that it's just a little stumble along the way.
Awesome. And then my next question is, I guess, for our audience, which is all clinical research focused, is there a particular book, resource, YouTube channel, anything like that, that you would perhaps recommend that you've, you know, enjoyed over the last couple of years?
You know, I take information from all different sources. And I think the idea of it, we don't want to ever get too narrow, because I think if it gets too narrow, then you sort of fall into a certain mindset. So look, I think STAT is a good resource to look at. I think The Economist is a good resource to look at. I think, you know, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, you know, I think you have to look at all different sorts of information. And I think the risk of taking all of your data from one place is that it reinforces some type of thinking. I think part of this strategy role is to continue to challenge yourself to think a little bit differently, to sort of push thinking. So I try to mix it up as much as I can. You know, I'll read a lot of books. I'll listen to different podcasts. I'll watch different streaming shows. Just sort of mix it up, because you never know where good ideas are going to come from. But they're probably not likely to come from the same source over and over again without looking at other stuff. So I, you know, it's like hard for me to ever pick a favorite book or pick a favorite movie, because yeah, there's pieces of those things that I've really liked, but it's not like I'd say, wow, I'm going to read that book 10 times. Like my kids could read Harry Potter 7 or 8 times. I mean, I've been through it like twice, but I couldn't read it 7 or 8 times. I mean, but they're finding value in that. So different people have different approaches. Does that make sense? I mean,
it does, Brian. And I think I've probably had about 150 plus people on this podcast. Normally they are in on one thing, but as soon as you started talking, I was like, this is a strategy man talking here. So I like that. It's that broader perspective again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Look, we've been talking a lot about work, So you mentioned a moment ago your son and kind of a fall breaking his arm, but look, what do you who's Brian outside of Advara? You know, what do you enjoy to do to relax?
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I love outdoor activities. I mean, I think those are, do a lot of exercise. And in fact, actually, one thing that's actually been well, there's two things that I did, both related to things I did in college. So let me start with the first one. My daughter took she was in high school, and she took a poetry class, modern poetry class. And I thought, overall poetry class. I thought, this is really interesting. So I went on to Coursera and started looking around, and I discovered this thing called ModPo, which was a poetry class offered at the University of Pennsylvania in the fall of last year. Right. And it's literally, you are part of, it's a separate class that runs along the same continuum as the normal course does. That was fun. So I actually took a poetry class last year, and I thought it was great. And then the other thing I did, which harkens back to college too, was I spend time out on Eastern Long Island, and there's a rowing club nearby. Mm. And I was a rower in college. I rowed lightweight crew for 4 years, and I hadn't rowed since. And over the last few weeks, I've started rowing again a couple times a week. Now it's different. It's not sweeps. So sweeps are single paddles. These are actually sculls. So we row pairs and quads. And I have to say, doubles and quads, pairs of the sweep. So doubles and quads. And I have to say that, and eventually I'll get to a skull, but that has been super fun. Because I like being out on the water. So I was doing all this paddleboarding. I always saw these guys with the boats, like, why aren't I doing that? And a friend of mine who I rode with in college said, you got to come and try this. Mm. And I'll say that's been great. So that's a little bit new, but sort of a little bit of not hearkening back. And but I think I like those. The class was super fun. And I'd encourage people to do that, or other classes. Just check them out. There's so much information out there and so much opportunity out there that you don't need to go register to school, and you can take it at your own time. Mm. And then this outdoor activity has been great. I'm going to keep rowing.
Incredible. Very diverse again. And look, to wrap up the show, my final question, and I guess, you've shared a lot already, but look, if you were to try and pin down one thing, what would be the golden rule for you in life and business?
Look, I think the golden rule is the golden rule. You know, treat people the way you'd want to be treated. I really do think that, and I think that level of empathy and understanding, whether it's peers or friends or clients, you know, if you're asking somebody to do something you wouldn't do, why are you asking them to do that?
So true.
You know, I think the golden rule is the golden rule for a reason, you know, and I really do believe that. I mean, I think you can be successful and be a good person. You don't have to cut corners to be successful. I mean, some people do, but I think you can live a good and happy life and also be successful. And by just treating people with a level of respect and understanding and empathy, and just carry that through for your life and all your endeavors. I mean, I think it's nice to be consistent between personal life and work life, not to have it overlap all the time, but it's a lot easier to be a consistent person across all aspects of your life than to be one person in the office and one person at home. I find that's just too much work.
Definitely. Well, I think you're a testament to that, Brian, I have to say, but it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. For anyone that wants to find out more about yourself or Advara, website, LinkedIn, what's the best place to check you guys out?
I mean, all of the above, website, LinkedIn, happy to chat and hopefully have an opportunity to, you know, to support the industry any way we can. And James, this has been super fun. Anytime you want me to come back, just let me know. We can talk about AI.
Oh yeah, exactly. Maybe I'll have to get you back shortly to talk about that. It'll be awesome. But Brian, absolute pleasure. Thanks again for joining me on the show.
My pleasure. And thanks so much for having me. Have a great rest of the day.